We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls. And we're happy to have back on the program, once again, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carle in Urbana. Every other month, on a Monday, he's here. And we open it up to healthcare questions. And a long time ago, we thought it would be a good idea for us, in as much as we do shows from time to time with specialists, it would be also a good idea to have a regular show that was with a more generalist, the kind of doctor who deals with people of all ages and people who come in with a wide range of health concerns. And we just open it up, and that's why we call it Talk to the Family Doctor. That's the idea. So any, just whatever's on your mind can be for yourself, can be for your children. Give us a call, and he will do his best to help you out. With the qualification I always give that, you know, there's some things we can't do because he can't see you. But it's a good place to start, and I'm sure he can answer some basic questions. So all you have to do is call us. And the number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Yeah. Good to be back.
We have someone ready to go already in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a daughter who's living in Chicago, and I just found out this past weekend that she wakes up every morning with her ears full of goop and crustacean, and I don't know how long it's been going on, a long time. And so I'm wondering, what does she do? What is that from, and how do you get rid of it?
Well, I think this is going to be a tough one to do over the radio because this is really going to require a physical examination of her ears. There are several different possibilities here. The outer part of the ear canal is basically skin, so there are a number of skin conditions that can simply affect the external part of the ear. And so things like seborrheic dermatitis is one potential explanation.
Say that again, sub what?
Seborrheic dermatitis. It's sort of a almost dandruff-like condition, mm-hmm. but in some conditions it'll become associated with some mucousy drainage. The other possibility is what people commonly refer to as swimmer's ear, which is an infection in the ear canal.
Well, she doesn't swim.
If the ear got wet in any way and didn't get a chance to dry out, the skin in the ear canal can break down and become secondarily infected. If you have a regular ear infection, the sort of ear infection that kids get, and your eardrum perforates, then basically infectious material from behind the eardrum can drain out. So there's a fair number of possibilities that could present here, and somebody's going to simply need to take a look at the ear to figure out which one of these it might be.
So she really needs to go to see a doctor.
Well, that would be a good start.
Yeah, well, she doesn't have any health insurance, and so she doesn't want to go. So that's the hard part.
That is a hard thing.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. On to another caller. This is Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. My question is, there's been a lot of controversy recently about the TSA test. Back in March in the New York Times, the discoverer, I think his name is Richard Alban, he discovered it, the antigen, in 1970. And he wrote an op-ed piece called The PSA Catastrophe. And I was wondering, what's your take on all of this?
Well, it's been, in some respects, controversial for some time in the sense that it's been widely recognized for a long time that the PSA is not the ideal screening test. A good test for screening would be able to differentiate between benign and malignant processes. The chemical substance of the antigen found in the prostate is normally present there and usually only in certain amounts at given ages. So there's a normal range for your PSA depending on your age. We know that in men, the prostate gland physically gets larger over time, and consequently the PSA level goes up. And again, so based on your age, there's an upper limit of normal. If your PSA is above that, it doesn't tell us whether it's above that simply because your prostate is bigger than average but still benign, or whether it's cancerous and that's why those abnormal cells are producing more PSA. So when you get an elevated PSA, you unfortunately end up doing biopsies, which is not necessarily a pleasant thing to have done, but it's the only way then to separate out, is this a benign enlargement of the prostate associated with more PSA, or is this an enlargement of the prostate due to prostate cancer? Once you identify that it's cancer, you get into the whole next set of controversy, which is how aggressively do I treat that? In terms of men, it's basically been said that if you live long enough, you will develop prostate cancer. So essentially, if you took 95-year-old men and biopsied all their prostates, you would find prostate cancer cells in there. But in all likelihood, they're going to die of something else, not as a result of having prostate cancer. So the controversy here is how do you figure out which are the aggressive tumors that would in fact prematurely kill somebody versus those that are slow-growing, indolent, would have never caused anybody to die and probably don't need to be treated.
Yeah.
So going forward, what's really needed is a better test that would allow the differentiation between benign enlargement of the prostate and prostate cancer, and then one step beyond that would be differentiation between those cancers that, if left alone, wouldn't cause any problem versus those that would actually be fatal.
Yeah.
The reason the PSA is used currently is it's literally the only test that's available. So,
yeah.
You know, it's the best we have right now.
Yeah. He was in a sense, arguing, as I recall, in an article and in some other articles he wrote, they really don't have a good way of, with a needle biopsy, of avoiding a whole lot of false positives.
And that's correct. Now, our urology colleagues think that, you know, it's still a good idea to do it because even if you end up getting a lot of false positives, even if you put a lot of people through biopsies, you are, with this big net, going to get the individuals who do, in fact, have aggressive prostate cancer. It's just that big net caught a lot of other people who probably didn't need to go through this whole experience.
It's also my take that they really don't have a good sense of how to screen the aggressive ones from the non-aggressive ones.
And that's true. That's the second part of the problem is figuring out, especially if with the PSA you're identifying cancers at a very, very early stage, how do you decide which ones you just watch versus which ones you aggressively either surgically remove or radiate to kill the prostate?
I think you're better off playing the lottery, I think.
Well, this raises the issue of, you know, just because somebody has cancer, does it automatically have to be treated? You know, if you
sure.
inadvertently found prostate cancer in somebody who had multiple other medical conditions that in all likelihood were going to be fatal long before they would ever die of their prostate cancer, one reasonable option is to simply say, well, then let's not treat the prostate cancer and put this person through all that.
Yeah. He was saying the only really a good use of the PSA test is that if you had cancer surgery done and then you had a subsequent PSA test and the PSA test went up really high, then he would be very concerned.
It probably is most effective in that situation that you just described. If a man has his prostate gland surgically removed, their PSA theoretically should go to zero.
Yeah.
So you can then follow the PSA over time. If it remains zero, that's a good indicator that their treatment has been successful. And as you correctly point out, if there's a sudden jump in their PSA, then it very strongly suggests that there's a metastatic deposit of prostate cancer somewhere else, and you need to go looking for that before it can spread further.
I guess the last thing on this was the main point he was saying is that for routine cancer screening, the PSA is, in almost in his words, worthless and is costing the VA and other agencies billions of dollars in lab tests and unnecessary cancer biopsies and this sort of thing. So.
Right. But part of the difficulty is that there are major guidelines from different medical organizations that recommend cancer screening, including prostate cancer screening, and failing to do recommended screening potentially generates some liability.
And so we
get into this sort of vicious cycle of, I'm doing the test because, you know, everybody else is doing the test, and maybe it's not a great test, but I'm afraid not to do it because I don't have an alternative to this test.
Where does the Urology Association stand on this at this time?
They're actually in favor of it, and I think from a historical standpoint, the reason they are is that they used to get prostate cancer patients with far advanced disease before there was any reliable good screening available. Not that this screening is all that reliable, but it's better than what we had before. So now they're faced actually with the opposite problem. They're picking up, you know, cancers literally at a microscopic level and raising the question of, okay, what's the appropriate way to handle that? In the past, they were getting, you know, stage four disease with guys who, you know, had bone metastases, and, you know, so they were actually quite happy that there was a test that would allow them to pick it up earlier. But a lot of things in medicine and science, you know, once you answer one question, it simply raises more questions about what's the next step.
Well, I thank you very much.
All right,
thanks
for the call. So just to be clear on this, that's the recommendation at this point still is that guys at at age 50, I guess,
correct,
supposed to for get your first test, and then the recommendation is that every year after that,
right,
you get checked.
But again, it'll depend on which set of guidelines you're looking at. The American Cancer Society, the American Urological Society say screening is a good thing. You look at the United States Task Force on Preventive Services. They were sort of controversially in the news this past year when they said, well, maybe mammograms aren't for everybody, and there was a big uproar about that. So that's part of the process of, you know, looking at the data, coming to a conclusion, you know, is that data applicable to a given individual, or are we talking about populations as a whole? You know, what do you do for that individual person? You're correct, the standard screening age is age 50, but we will in fact start sooner than that if prostate cancer is in your family history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you say, well, gee, Dad had prostate cancer when he was, you know, 52, well, we're going to probably start at 42 for you because we know that there's going to be some biological predisposition to you developing prostate cancer. And again, we're going to try and pick it up early because the general thought is if you take care of it early, it's not going to be allowed to progress, advance, and spread. And so if that theory is true, then picking it up early should be beneficial in terms of somebody's life expectancy. But the biology of prostate cancer is such that maybe some of these were just going to sit there forever anyway, and not cause a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that that doctors do what they should to help patients understand their options? And I guess I'm thinking, is it, you know, you're going to go into the doctor and the doctor says, okay, here's what we found. Here's the possible treatments. Go ahead, pick. And is it really all up to the patient, or are doctors really going to say, well, let's talk about this and let me see if I can help you make a decision? Not that I'm going to tell you what to do, mm-hmm. but also I'm not just going to leave you out there on the limb, right. all on your own.
Right. To be honest, a lot of patients don't think about it. They just sort of do what's recommended to them. So depending on how much concern somebody has about their particular situation, I think it's perfectly appropriate to discuss the relative pros and cons of having it tested. If somebody said, gee, if my PSA came back elevated, I wouldn't want to have a biopsy, then, you know, why are we going to check it?
Yeah.
If somebody said, gee, I have bad heart disease and Parkinson's and I'm probably not going to live more than, you know, 2 or 3 years, why do I even want to look for prostate cancer? Which is a very valid question. And there are some discussions in the medical literature about saying at a particular age or given a particular medical condition, maybe it's just not appropriate to do routine screening anymore because the harms associated with screening, subsequent biopsies, subsequent treatment may actually be worse than not having done anything at all. And in terms of screening, a lot of screenings, say colon cancer, mammograms for breast cancer, PSAs, most of the original studies had an upper age limit. They usually quit at age 75. So, you know, when people get beyond 75 and they ask the question, well, what are the recommendations for screening? The answer is, well, nobody really knows because nobody's ever studied this group. Mm-hmm. So we basically have taken earlier studies and just extrapolated them and pushed them out sometimes to sort of ridiculous lengths. But that's where we're at right now.
All right. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. Every other month he's here for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Chicago. Hello. Line 4.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a question on hormone replacement therapy. I'm presently 63 years old. I was on hormone replacement therapy for 10 years, from 48 to 58, according to my gynecologist's directions. I have now, for 5 years, not had any type of hormone replacement therapy. During that period of time, luckily I didn't have any breast cancer. I had a colonoscopy, no polyps. I had a DEXA scan. It kept my bones in great shape. But now I'm having issues with cholesterol, you know, going very high. My DEXA scan came out with my bone problems. My mood is horrendous. And I cannot find a OB-GYN that would prescribe it to me because they say that the progesterone in it would pose a risk of stroke or heart disease at my age if I went back on it. What is your opinion on hormone replacement therapy? At the time, okay, that the Women's Initiative study came out, my gynecologist, who I had for like 35 years, told me, disregard it because it is not a valid study. He was basing his prescriptions on a previous study. What do you think, doctor?
You have raised a really big issue and opened up a big can of worms.
No,
I'd like to go back sort of historically and sort of review the process. A number of years ago, it was noted that premenopausal women had a much lower incidence of heart disease than men or postmenopausal women. And so the theory, and that's what it was, the theory was is that something about menopause then made it more likely for women to develop heart disease. Well, the sort of simplistic answer was, well, obviously, you know, you lose your estrogen as a result of menopause. So we'll just give it back, and therefore women will have that low premenopausal rate of heart disease. And so basically, women in the United States participated in a giant experiment, which, as a result of additional then detailed studies, when they sort of looked at all the data, it didn't turn out to be true. It was one of those hypotheses that just wasn't proven. So there was no cardiovascular benefit to women on estrogen replacement. And in fact, there was a slightly increased risk of breast cancer due to estrogen stimulation of estrogen-sensitive breast cancers. But you correctly pointed out it was beneficial for bone density. So there was a really very mixed bag of results, but everybody who said, gee, you should be on estrogen to protect your heart probably was not done a service. Now, women who benefited in terms of their bone density and didn't have any negative effects, that turned out to be positive. You mentioned the other thing in terms of mood. That's a little harder one to, you know, measure with a laboratory or X-ray test, but it certainly affects somebody's quality of life.
Right.
At this particular point, if your uterus is still present, we don't give estrogen by itself because that can stimulate abnormal buildup of the lining of the uterus and, in a few instances, uterine cancer, endometrial cancer, I should say, can develop. So if your uterus is still present, you usually get a combination of estrogen and progesterone to prevent that lining from building up. If your uterus is absent, then you don't need to take progesterone, and just estrogen is probably fine. The conversation that's typically had now is if your symptoms relative to menopause are so miserable, you know, life isn't worth living, then being on low-dose estrogen replacement for a short period of time to try and sort of segue from being premenopausal to postmenopausal is considered okay if you don't have any strong predisposing factors such as, you know, everybody in my family has breast cancer, everybody drops dead of heart disease immediately. So
that is the question
right.
that my gynecologist said. Do you have a history of cancer? Now, for those 10 years I've had mammograms, I've never had, thank God, any cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the disease in my family is very high in cardiovascular.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, while I was on the estrogen, you know, it was every other day, the lowest dose. My cholesterol was in good order.
Mm-hmm.
I did not develop that midsection, you know, which I've developed right now. I mean, I do eat healthy and I exercise. And, you know, there's diabetes in the family. And I'm just saying, why all of a sudden? He said, after 5 years, it's like you never were on this therapy.
Correct.
Okay, he says, after 5 years, you're going to see your body starting to show effects, and it's like you were never on them.
You will also demonstrate any inherited family tendencies as well.
Right.
So issues related to cholesterol may potentially have nothing to do with estrogen replacement and everything to do with an inherited genetic tendency.
Okay.
So that needs to be sorted out as well.
Yeah. Well, there was a gynecologist on, I just didn't get her name, from Champaign, who, you know, said in some instances they would consider. Do you know of any doctor in Chicago that I could go to that would even consider this as far as an OB-GYN, because the younger doctors, they absolutely say no. It's, you know, a cardiovascular problem. You probably could have a stroke or you could have a heart attack the first year of being on this. But if I take aspirin therapy, would that still hold?
That helps. This is one of those situations that has to be
discussed.
Well, it has to be discussed in the context of your total cardiovascular health. So, you know, some of the issues that will impact this, you know, do you smoke? Are you overweight? Do you exercise? Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? What's your cholesterol? You know, if I have a woman who has very little or no cardiovascular risk factors, and she says my life is miserable because of, you know, hot flashes and mood swings and I can't sleep, and I'd like to be on estrogen for a short period of time, I personally don't think that's unreasonable. Now, if somebody says, you know, I have all of the cardiovascular risk factors associated with heart disease, then that's probably not a good choice.
Okay. All right.
So you know, and obviously people are going to be somewhere in between, but is it totally unreasonable? The answer is no in select situations.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your answer, Doctor.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We're at our midpoint here. Again, our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana, and every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, he's here for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor, and what we try to do is give people a chance to ask some basic questions about their health concerns. It may well come to the point where you really have to go and see someone and talk about it with them, because as the doctor says, you know, you got to get a sense of who that patient is and their medical history and what's going on with them, and that may involve some laying on of hands. So,
well,
not necessarily something we can do here.
As I mentioned, the whole experience with estrogen replacement was in essence a large scale experiment. But if you look at it historically, I don't know how many decades ago, but you know what happened postmenopausally really wasn't much of an issue. If you look at the long history, because people didn't live that long,
right?
So now that people do live long enough to be postmenopausal 10, 20, 30 years, the questions become, what should we be doing about that? Yeah. And the answer is, well, nobody really knows for sure. We tried one thing. It didn't work out all that well. So, you know, what's the next step? As I'm fond of saying, life is an experiment. And whether you want to put yourself in the experimental group or the control group is, you know, pretty much up to that particular individual to decide for themselves. But there's a lot of basic medical treatment that right this second, we can't say 100%, oh, well, we have 50-year studies that show X or Y or Z. You know, we have experience over the last 10 years, 15 years. Well, what does that mean? You know, out at 25 or 30 years, don't know yet.
And I suppose it's, and I certainly don't mean to be prescribing here or, you know, making any comment on that caller, but there are other kinds of treatments. Say, if you're concerned about osteoporosis, there are non-hormonal treatments, and if you're concerned about cholesterol, there are statins, and there are other ways at responding to these symptoms. So, you know, maybe again, that would be the thing that you want to talk about. Well, how many different ways is it possible to address these things?
But each one of those alternatives in and of itself comes with the whole discussion of what are the benefits, what are the potential side effects? You know, the bisphosphonate group of medications for building bone density, has anybody been on them for 50 years? No. Same thing for the statins. We know they're good at lowering cholesterol. Anybody been on them for 50 years? No. So, you know, these types of questions are quite valid to ask. You know, what happens if I stay on this for a long time? And the answer is nobody knows yet. But there's a large group of people who are participating in essentially a population-based study to find out what does happen.
Well, let's go on to another caller, a couple of other callers here. Indiana is next, line one. Hello.
Hello. couple of anecdotal things and a question regarding when you mentioned that in the past that after you got to a certain age, doctors didn't think it was particularly important to do certain tests because you were going to eventually die from one of the things they'd be testing and not much they could do about it. I've had a couple classmates just recently. One found a note on behind her ear, and within a month or so, she was dead from brain cancer. Another person, a similar thing. Now, in regards to the PSA, I was told that it doesn't move real fast. And a buddy of mine from my class had his PSA went from 4 to 5, his urologist suggested biopsy, which they did do. He said there were like 17 or 18 places they take a sample, and 4 of them he had a cancer showed. And the doctor says, well, we got to start watching that in the next couple of years. And my friend said, no, hell no. He said, I'm going to have it taken out right now. And I thought that was a little over the top. And so I'm sort of wondering what age is it where you can say, well, I don't know if I need a PSA or not. My last PSA, which was last year, was 0.48. And if I remember, the spread was like 0 through 4 for normality.
Correct.
And so I'm sort of, and my life partner is adamant about forgetting. Don't do the PSA. Everything I've read on the internet says that time they find it, you'll probably die from something else anyway. I sort of have a domestic thing to go through. Plus, just a sensible question. I'm 71. And I just wondered, at this stage, does the cancer in the prostate move fast, like I've discovered in other places it does, or is it a more slower thing in the sense that it wouldn't be a super deal thing that I have to have it tested this year, maybe every other year? Does that make any sense?
The questions you ask are very, very reasonable, and there are no definitive hard answers.
Yeah.
So, as a general rule, cancers that show up earlier in life tend to be very aggressive.
Okay.
Cancers that show up later in life, and again, these are generalizations, tend to be less aggressive.
Okay.
So in many instances, you look at somebody's age and you look at their other medical conditions, and you sort of do a little calculation in your head as to, what's likely to get me first.
Okay.
And if it basically says, if you're 80 and you have an early prostate cancer, but you already have, heart disease, diabetes,
right,
vascular, it's not likely that your prostate cancer is going to kill you.
Okay.
In all likelihood, your heart disease will.
I just don't have any trust in the internet, actually. Anybody can put up his name, Dr. John Brown, blah, blah, blah. But she's done a lot of cross-checking and everything.
Mm-hmm.
She's, educated and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And she's been more or less not hounding me, but...
Well, interestingly enough, there have been some studies that have suggested that men early in life, if in their 40s, they had very, very low PSAs. They statistically had less likelihood of going on to develop prostate cancer in the future. The other issue that's being looked at is calculating what people refer to as a PSA velocity, which is simply the rate of change of your PSA over time. As we mentioned before, your PSA is going to go up as your prostate gets a little bit bigger. But if it goes up very, very slowly, very, very gradually, that's probably just that, benign enlargement of your prostate. If all of a sudden it jumps up significantly, then that's a little bit more suspicious. And in situations where you're trying to find cancer early, that would be a time to do a biopsy.
If we wiped out all tests and only relied upon the forefinger for feeling the prostate, is there good information on that?
That's
what my life partner falls back on. She says, well, Dr. Bennett has not said anything at all about enlargement.
Right. Basically, you're feeling for, on the physical examination, a nodularity, a lump or a bump on the back side of the prostate. For that to be noticeable in terms of picking up a cancer, things are usually fairly advanced. You are not going to pick up prostate cancer at a microscopic level that you can now if you use the PSA to direct your biopsy.
Okay.
So is it a great test? No. But again, it falls into the category of what else do we have? And the answer is not a lot.
That's where my head is right now. I mean, it's the only thing I've got, so
right.
to speak. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
It's actually been helpful.
All right, very good. Well, and you know, maybe also one other thing about the digital exam, you're not able to feel the entire prostate.
No, you're feeling
so you're
the back side of the prostate.
Of it.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So that there's only so much that's going to be able to tell you.
Right. But the other thing that's often being done at that same time is, in addition to physically palpating the prostate, you're looking for any type of rectal tumor. And you can also check for blood in the stool at that time, which is part of colon evaluation.
Okay. So, again, just for the record, as far as the mainstream medical community is concerned, the advice still is that at age 50, barring, considering your medical history,
right.
age 50, get your first screening PSA once a year after that, and then also to have the physical exam as part of an annual. It should be an annual thing.
Correct. In most instances for cancer screening, there are very few situations where you can say, oh, just do the test and not do the exam.
Mm-hmm.
Even with, say, mammograms for women looking for breast cancer, there are times physically when you say there's an abnormality here and they don't see anything on the mammogram and vice versa. So in most instances, the combination of physical examination and whatever testing you're doing is better than either one of them by themselves.
Yeah. And the point I remember talking to somebody a long time ago about prostate issues and we were talking about the PSA, which stands for prostate-specific antigen. And he said, now remember, it's prostate-specific. It's not cancer-specific. What
exactly
it means
right.
is something's going on with the prostate, and it could be an infection. You know, it could be – that doesn't necessarily mean that you have cancer. But at least we have, as you said before, we have that test. It's a blood test. No big deal. You know, draw some blood, mm-hmm. you do the test. Do you – is it the thought that maybe, as time goes along here, we'll have better screening and maybe even another – blood test, so that'll be an easy, non-invasive test, but will give you more and better information.
That is sort of the holy grail right now. And yes, there is a lot of research going into a test that's not prostate specific, but prostate cancer specific. And that would be a world of improvement in terms of being able to sort out who needs to be biopsied. And then the next step then, who needs to be treated.
All right. To Champagne. Caller here, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, involves antibiotics and their use and sometimes abuse. If you have one of those weird PSAs that you're not quite sure about and you do a biopsy, can you do that without antibiotics if you're reasonably or you're healthy otherwise, and your body has an ecology of reasonable resistance to disease and what have you. The use of an antibiotic that wipes out everything that's in your body seems to be fairly aggressive. Is there a possibility that even though it's in the rectum, that you could have that area sterilized so that you do a biopsy without necessarily having to have antibiotics?
There really isn't any practical way of sterilizing that area. Unfortunately, the prostate biopsy goes right through the rectal wall into the prostate, and there's innumerable number of bacteria normally present in the rectum. And as long as they stay in the rectum, that's doesn't cause any problems, but as soon as you potentially introduce them into some other location, there's a very real risk of infection. And basically, the current recommendations for antibiotic prophylaxis come from the fact that without antibiotic prophylaxis, there will be a certain number of infections. You correctly point out that, you know, we're potentially infected with lots of things in lots of different ways. And if your immune system is good, then you may in fact fight that off. But there really isn't any way to tell on an individual basis, you know, who's going to be able to get away without an antibiotic and who's not. So it has become a general standard recommendation to do antibiotics before a prostate biopsy.
And if you go in there with a biopsy, how much damage does that do to the prostate?
You're basically poking a number of holes on the left and right side of the prostate, depending on how many samples they're trying to take. The key is to get enough tissue that when you look at it underneath the microscope, that you're going to be able to tell benign prostate cells from malignant prostate cells. And so there has to be a certain volume of tissue obtained, and you like to know where it came from, so that you can decide where the cancer might be. And yes, I mean, you're going to put a number of holes in the prostate, and the potential for bleeding or infection is definitely there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of Focus with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor from Carl in Urbana. It's our Talk to the Family Doctor show. We do it every other month, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
While we have a moment, I just want to remind people that October is a good time to get your annual flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
And the basically, the flu shot clinics by the various medical organizations and the health department and your local pharmacy. I mean, there's going to be a lot of different places that people can get a flu shot, and this is a good time to remind people to not forget that.
Last year, because of the concerns over H1N1 and the fact that developed after the flu vaccine was produced, we were in a situation where if people really wanted to get full protection, they had to get two shots.
And that won't be the case this year. As you mentioned, once the flu vaccine's produced, you're pretty much stuck with what you've got, because it takes approximately 9 months to produce the vaccine. So shortly after the completion of one season, they're working on the next season. But they specifically put H1N1 in this year's regular seasonal flu shot. So unless some other unheard of strain suddenly materializes, the standard seasonal flu shot will have the usual culprits contained in it, along with the H1N1.
And just before we got going here, you said that you thought it was a good thing that this time around the recommendations for who should get the shot
much simpler now. It's basically everybody above the age of 6 months should get a flu shot. Now, for some individuals who say, well, you know, I don't like shots, there is the flu nasal spray, which has a more limited group that it's approved for. Basically, I think it's ages 2 through 49. So if you're under 2, you're still supposed to get a flu shot. And if you're over, you know, if you're 50 or above, you should get a flu shot. But if you're otherwise healthy, between the ages of 2 and 49, the flu mist, the nasal spray, is approved for otherwise healthy, non-pregnant patients.
All right. Some other callers here. We'll try to get them all. First, Muhammad, line one. Hello? Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about polymyalgia rheumatica. Over the last year, it has become more common than not for my muscles to just ache all the time. I'm an active person. I play tennis. I walk 2 to 4 miles 4 or 5 days a week. I exercise, I garden, etc. Are we talking old age and inevitable, or is that a diagnosis that you might want to talk about?
Okay.
Or that I might want to consider?
To say that every achy muscle is due to polymyalgia rheumatica would not be correct. What's abbreviated PMR, because saying polymyalgia rheumatica all the time is time-consuming. But PMR is in the realm of rheumatologic disease, where a inflammatory response against an otherwise normal structure in the body occurs. It's in the group of diseases in terms of rheumatology, things like temporal arteritis. If you go to rheumatoid arthritis, we're dealing with situations where, for some really unknown reason, the body's immune system attacks some part of the body, producing symptoms. So in polymyalgia rheumatica, people will complain truly of muscular discomfort. It tends to be in the more proximal muscles, the shoulders and hips, as opposed to the distal muscles, say, you know, your hands or your feet. But characteristically, it's associated with a very elevated sedimentation rate, which is a test for inflammation. And that's probably the first thing that would be looked for to check for that possibility.
Well, mine, in fact, is the outer edge of my shoulders and arms, I would say, between the shoulder and the elbow, and my hips in general. Is it true that this might dissipate by itself, or is this a, if indeed this is the condition, would it go on without treatment?
It will usually go on considerably with if not treated, and in fact can become progressive over months to years, and basically spread to other portions of the body. And
so the treatment that I've heard is, of course, prednisone, which I'm jumping the gun here, but if that were to be the treatment, that's not appealing to me. Is there an alternative? Someone had mentioned some drugs such as Lyrica or that sort of thing.
Those types of medication are often helpful for the discomfort associated with neuromuscular conditions, but is in no way a treatment for the underlying inflammatory response. Your concern about prednisone is certainly well-founded. In large doses over long periods of time, there's a very, very long list of potential serious side effects related to that. But it is, in fact, the mainstay of treatment for things like PMR and temporal arteritis. And so it's very, very important that you have a correct diagnosis and the correct indications for using the medication. But other medications are not substitutes in terms of treatment.
If the sed rate turns out to not be high, then is it... could I assume that I can just continue treating it the way I am, which is with some over-the-counter pain medication on occasion and continue my activities? I mean,
yes.
Bed rate's not high. I don't know what else to, can account for it, but it really has become noticeable over the last year.
Right. Now, you know, then you simply go through the list of other possibilities. If people are on statin medications for their cholesterol, One of the side effects of it is muscular discomfort, and so frequently we'll take people off of that to see if that might explain it.
Yeah, I have no blood pressure issues, no cholesterol issues. I am on estrogen and progesterone on the lowest doses, but no other medications on a regular basis.
And then you go back to looking at, do I have arthritis in those joints near my muscles? X-rays and other types of testing can sometimes help answer that. Are my activities in and of themselves causing my problem? Am I trying to do too much too often?
One very quick question. Hydrocodone, as a treatment for relieving the pain on a limited basis, talk to me about the dosages of acetaminophen that they say are not to be exceeded.
Okay. Hydrocodone is a narcotic pain reliever. It's frequently combined with acetaminophen in combination medications. It's currently recommended that people not take more than 4,000 milligrams of acetaminophen in a 24-hour, and many people are now actually saying it really shouldn't be more than 3,000 milligrams of acetaminophen. And people need to look carefully because a number of prescription and over-the-counter products contain acetaminophen, so it's not impossible to take a variety of different things and all of a sudden find yourself taking too much.
Right. Well, it would be one or the other as far as I'm concerned. Do you have any hesitations about a limited amount of hydrocodone without any other over-the-counter medications?
This kind of gets into sort of a personal philosophical debate on whether you should be using narcotics for, you know, non-cancerous, non-serious forms of aches and pains. I'm personally not a big fan of that, but there are other physicians who feel that you can very safely use small amounts of medication on an ongoing basis.
I'm apologize to the caller. I'm simply going to have to jump in here and say that we're at the end of the time, and I'm very sorry we have another caller we can't take. But the time has gone. Dr. Jeff will be back with us again next in 2 months, so that'll be a while till he is here again. But we do have him here on the program every other month. It's always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. We try to answer as many questions as we can. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And thank you very much for being here.
I'll be back in December to make sure you got your flu shot.
We'll talk then.
Okay.
All right.